do I give it away?
Consign it to the earth with blood, said Kamala, before tossing her head at the scorched earth. Bury it in the ground.
Despite the curiosity burning inside me to know that last memory, I forced it away. It was part of me, but separate, and I wouldn't let it define me. I used the sharp edge of the stone to prick the pad of my finger.
Ooh, crooned Kamala. How about a lick, then?
Ignoring her, I smeared blood across the stone and dropped it to the ground. It landed with a silent thud against the dirt. I knelt toward the stone, bringing the memory close to my eye. I let myself sink into it just barely, teasing only the slightest detail of the memory before I forced myself to drop it. I blinked back the barest of images, a samite curtain, an upturned hand. I held the emotion coiled inside me, the knowledge that the memory was potent. Beloved, my voice trembled. This is what sacrifice I offer you for passage to the other world. Take a memory that I lay claim to only in name, but not in spirit. I will be less whole without it. But let the weight of it, its promise of love and tears, of something lost and beautiful, serve as fair barter. I kicked a small hole into the ground and buried the memory there. Earth ate the offering, flashing pale threads of tubers like gnashing teeth until the stone had disappeared. Above, thunder groaned in the bellies of the sky. Kamala and I both started, shocked by the sound. Thunder never used to bother me, but this was a horrible, wrenching sound, like the sky screaming. Kamala inhaled sharply.
Look!
I turned. The memory was gone. The hole I had made for it had fallen in on itself. Moon-bright roots clung to the sides, forming a tunnel veined with quartz.
Is that how?
Kamala began. Yes, I said, pushing her back. Get in, get in.
I don't like being underground.
Not the time, I said. I squatted to the ground, kicking my legs into the hole, and suppressed a shiver. It was cold and damp, but not like dirt. Like sweat-covered skin cooling in the wind.
Ready? Absolutely not.
I grabbed hold of her reins, not looking for an answer. And then we slid forth. Chapter 25. Impossible Hunger. Roots tore through my hair, loads of quartz banded around the tunnel, but the light was stingy and pale, and refused to illuminate what lay ahead. I threw my hands out against the dark. My insides slammed together and left me weightless. Dark fell in such cold, thick veils that for a moment I didn't know whether my eyes were open. I blinked, squeezing my eyes shut before opening them just in time to see the earth leaping out to meet us. My shoulder knifed into the ground. Light spiraled across my vision, and pain needled into my joints. Kamala tumbled beside me. The moment she found her bearings, she cast a withering glance my way.
I do not like you.
I winked at her. She bared her teeth at me. Around us, the night bazaar was more than just unrecognizable. It was gone. Where the sky had once been divided by perpetual day and night, it now appeared uniformly black. Haphazardly strewn gems poked out of the ground, casting a cold light that joined the glow of bone-white corpses hanging from trees in a shadowy orchard. The vendor stalls were gone. Snapped wheels, chipped signs, and shattered jars littered the outskirts of a large clearing in the middle of the bazaar. Except for some shriveled trees, it was deserted. Everything had a haunted look. Scorch marks covered the dais where the Gandharva musicians had once played beautiful music. And in the orchard, where Amar had handed me a fey fruit, nothing remained but charred stumps. Beside me, Kamala suppressed a shiver before glancing around. Sounds fluttered from a haze-riddled section of the night bazaar. The noise was at once soft and deafening, like a frenzied heartbeat or a scream unleashed underwater.
He is here.
I didn't need to ask who. I pulled my robes tightly across me. Heat slapped the air, but the atmosphere held not warmth, but fury. The ground changed beneath us. Where it had been coarse and ashy, now it was smooth and cool. I glanced down and my stomach flipped. We were walking on sanded bones. Their slender, asymmetrical shapes were fitted together like slats of wood. Strange crenulations, like teeth marks, dented the bone floor, and I looked away sharply. By now, my sandals were hardly more than thread, and I could feel each bone's smooth ridges curl beneath my feet. The sounds around the corner were deafening and chaotic, not at all like the alluring music the Gandharvas played. Even the air felt foreign. Where the night bazaar once smelled of secrets and the promise of adventure, the smell of the netherworld had a cloying unpleasantness, ripe with the stench of fermenting fruit and sulfur. "What happened to everyone else?" I asked. Kamala shuddered, her withers rippling with goosebumps.
"They have fled."
"Where did they go?"
"In the trees, in the rivers, in the glens," murmured Kamala, swaying her head from side to side. "In all the hidey holes left in the world."
I remembered the first time I came to the night bazaar, how the crowds parted like water before Amar and me, how their gaze was frantic, but always reverent. He had kept them safe. Whatever had happened, they must not have thought he could keep them safe anymore. I couldn't blame them. The night bazaar was in disarray. Lightning hung from the torn seams of the sky, flickering weakly in the air. The shadowy dome above held no signs of the sun, moon, or stars. Here, there were chalky square outlines in the floor, where towering rakshas wrestled and sparred. In a darkened corner, a horde of footless boots swayed in a terrifying dance to the rhythm of their own screams. On the outskirts stretched an expanse of black water. Something skimmed the waves. Great fins and a jaw jutted outward, poised for biting and crowded with teeth. A timingala. Its eyes never blinked, and I couldn't shake the feeling that they were fixed on me, shining with hunger.
"I miss my cremation ground," said Kamala, sniffing disdainfully at the scene before us.
I ignored her, my throat suddenly tight. I saw Amar, perched on a towering throne of thorns. There was no compassion in his eyes, only steel. But there was also a blank look to his expression, as though he couldn't quite remember how he'd gotten there or what he was supposed to do next. Images rustled beneath my skin, lighting up behind my eyes. I saw us along the ocean at the edge of the world, his hands twisting the black curls of my hair. I saw him standing near the shore, smiling as he placed a wreath of rosemary and honey myrtle around my head like a crown. I saw our fingers interlace, felt the roughness of his hands against my own, and heard him speak my name like a prayer. Beside him, Nrithi leaned out on a throne of bleached bones, her full lips curled in a smile as she lifted one perfectly groomed eyebrow and surveyed the destruction. A hum gurgled through the air, like a thousand stomachs rumbling. A wrenching pain twisted through my gut, and I doubled over. Beside me, Kamala keened. A Dakini sank to her knees in front of us, her necklace of animal skulls scraping against the ground and flinging dirt onto my legs. Five Pays wailed and clawed at their faces, so deeply that blood welled to the surface. They sucked on their fingers greedily. I fought against the fug of magic. It was an enchantment of hunger. I'd never known an appetite this furious. It was in my skin, under my nails, like grit between my teeth. My throat was parched. The air tasted stale on my tongue, but I lapped at it anyway. I wanted to fill up my emptiness with anything, everything.
"Do you feel it?"
hissed Kamala. Her hoof stamped the ground like the hunger was just an itch she could get rid of. Even if I could speak, I didn't have the chance. A sound bellowed at the front of the chamber.
"Too long we have been confined to the rules of the other world. Too long we have starved for more than the scraps the universe throws our way," said a voice.
"Nrithi."
But I ask that you stay hungry just a little longer before we glut ourselves on the world. For our victory, I want you hungry. My head snapped up. I clamped down on my lower lip so hard that the rust and salt taste of blood surged in my mouth. I licked it away, focusing all my attention on her. I stepped forward unsteadily, my feet slipping, legs bowing under the weight of unnatural starvation. "We are! We are!" chanted a thousand voices. "I want you aching!" she crooned. One more step, another, another. I was dragging my feet through the dirt, fighting my way to the front. "We do! We do!" rose up the voices. "Good," she said. "Tonight, in honor of my pending nuptials—" She stopped to stroke a finger against Amar's cheek. He shuddered, and my heart flipped. "I will let you go anywhere you please." Horror surpassed hunger. I pictured all these horrible bodies slinking across the lands I loved, living nightmares with empty stomachs and lips pulled back to reveal teeth made for rending. Gowri's determined face flashed in my mind. No. Nrithi stood, reaching behind her for the boy I recognized from the glen. He stared up at her, and his face was incandescent with joy. He was so distracted that he did not see the blade glinting or notice how Nrithi's smile stretched thin and predatory. "Let this soul pave our way," screamed Nrithi to the crowd. They roared with happiness, surging together. Bodies pressed against my back, and I reached out blindly for Kamala. Her muzzle pushed against my neck, and her jaws snapped when a churl moved too close to me. The churl's feet were twisted, her toes wrenched in the opposite direction of her face, and when she met my gaze, I saw her longing, hands twitching to feel something more than dust against palms, lolling mouth aching to be slaked with shuddering hearts and slick organs, anything to feel alive. Amar never once raised his head. Beside Nrithi, he was a shadow. I leapt onto Kamala's back and leaned close to her ear. "Run!" And she did. Nrithi raised the knife, her head tilting, voice crooning. Her voice broke my heart, but still we kept moving, never stopping. Lightning flickered above us. A pay lay trampled in the rush. I never once looked away from Nrithi. I didn't know what had happened to the girl who had been my best friend. Whatever reasons once existed had gathered moss and dust in their edges. All that mattered now was the scene before me, laughter seeping into my ears, the floors thick with spilled blood, hunger that hollowed your innards and coated your tongue with dust. Kamala reared to a halt, her forelegs clinging for purchase. I leaned across her back, my hand outstretched. "Stop!" There was a moment where I didn't know if anyone had heard. My word felt like little more than a croak. Silence fell around us. Nrithi's blade clattered to the ground, and the boy stumbled back, unscathed. Amar's head snapped up, and for the first time since leaving Nautica, we stared at one another. His expression hadn't changed since the glen. It was flat, but not unkind, just out of reach. He looked as though someone had summoned him from stone. The more I looked at him, the more images prickled behind my eyes. Him walking toward me, in one hand carrying a glass rose, while his fingers reached for me, eager to close the space between us. His hand slung over my waist while we slept, two bodies curled into the shadow of each other. But those images were mine alone. Amar blinked, his brows furrowing before he looked away. My heart slammed against my ribs. If I had any doubt about his last words, that he wouldn't remember me, that I would be lost to him, this moment cured them. I was a stranger. Chapter 26. A Duel of Riddles. Nrithi was staring at us, and her face was blank and controlled. I leapt from Kamala's back, the gaze of a thousand eyes slapped against my skin. "Think, Maya." Anger flared inside me. Anger that she had ousted those who belonged here
and ushered in those who did not. Anger that Amar was by her side. Anger that she had lied. But I tamped it down, swallowing my fury like a bitter draught. And then I did what anyone would do before a false sovereign. I bowed. Kamala glanced at me sidelong, a ghoulish grin across her face.
I know what she is hungry for, and she is starved as the earth. Her teeth are grinding, grinding, churning stars. Do you hear it, false Sadhvi?
What are you talking about? I muttered back, my head still bent to the ground. What is she hungry for? Kamala leaned closer.
You.
A whip cracked through the air, and I jerked my head up, only to see Nrithi standing right in front of me. She tilted her head to one side, and the movement was so slight, so emotionless, that I thought she would slide a blade through me just to see what would happen.
I do not believe I asked your opinion, Sadhvi, she said.
I dropped my gaze, my neck burning. She didn't seem to know me. Then again, I was unrecognizable as the girl who had eaten up her lies in Nautica. But just to be sure, I pulled one end of my robes over my head. The point of a knife pricked my throat, tilting my head up.
Perhaps I should just use you instead.
I froze, twisting down the fear that had stolen my breath. I wouldn't give her the satisfaction of letting my heartbeat pulse against the metal. My hands curled into fists, ready to grab her blade, when someone's voice echoed in the ruined night bazaar. Amar. He was standing, his hands outstretched. Fury shadowed his face, but in a blink it was gone. His expression warred between lost and enraged.
I want her to speak, said Amar. Speak your mind, Sadhvi. You are under my protection.
Nrithi dropped the blade by a fraction, but her gaze wasn't on me. It was on Amar. Hope fluttered in my ribs. Nrithi looked at Amar like he was a tame tiger who had unexpectedly torn out the throat of an animal. She looked at Amar with a flash of fear in her eyes, and hope poured through my veins. No amount of captivity could strip the wild from the tiger. Amar was no different. He was feral. He was mine. Nrithi, recovering from her lapse of silence, delivered a low bow.
As you wish, my lord, but if we are to follow through with our plans, we need a soul. What better than the one that offers itself so freely?
She pointed to the little boy at the edge of the dais, knees drawn up to his chin, staring at Nrithi like she was his salvation.
Look at him. He longs to be cut. I should do as he asks.
Your enchantment has robbed his will, I shot back, the words tumbling out before I had a chance to stop them. Wrong move. Kamala moved closer, her nose nudging into my shoulder, nostrils flaring protectively. I wanted to hug her. Beside me, a churl sucked in her breath, and a Rakshasi stumbled backward, as if my words would put all of their lives at risk. The crowd around us laughed, but it was thin and forced. Nrithi leaned closer to me.
When we have hollowed the world above, wouldn't death be a kind of fate to the boy? Do you want him to return to find his home destroyed? Because that is what they will do.
In the ruins of the night bazaar, I was all too aware of my own mortality. My heartbeat enthralled them. I was food. If they could not have the boy's blood, they would take mine.
You are bound to be a great ruler, my lady. But on the eve of your victory, perhaps you can spare a favor to a lowly Sadhvi?
Nrithi glared, her jaw tight, but she nodded.
How about a game? I asked. Give me a riddle. If I answer correctly, you will grant me the boy.
Nrithi grinned.
I will play your game, Sadhvi, but if you answer wrong, you will take his place.
Kamala hissed into my ear.
Are you so eager to die, young queen?
But on one condition, I said. Her eyes narrowed.
What?
I looked from her to Amar. This whole time, his eyes had never left my face. I request a private audience with the Dharmaraja. His face was impassive, but he nodded in my direction, and the smallest of victories lodged between my ribs, light as a heartbeat, and just as hopeful. Around us, the crowd of darker beings sank into the shadows. Some licked their lips, others just stared.
"You will receive no help," said Nrithi.
She reached down, tugging at the air like it was a handful of chains. Gupta was yanked out from behind the throne of thorns. His face was haggard, dirt creasing his skin. I lunged toward him, but Nrithi slammed her heel into the ground, and a wall of wind threw me back.
"None of that," she chided. "Take the pishacha."
Gupta nodded. I tried to make eye contact with him, but he refused to meet my gaze. Kamala whinnied, rearing onto her legs, fighting to stay close to me.
"We have a deal,"
Kamala whispered into my ear. Her voice trembled.
"You may not die. Not until I have a bite or two of that lush arm like you promised. If you die, I will kill you."
I searched myself for a smile. "Have you grown fond of me, then?"
"As one who has grown fond of a particular dish. Nothing more."
She huffed, but she wouldn't look at me. Gupta dragged her away. My hope felt bruised and cold. Winds teased the ends of my shorn hair, and the sadhvi robes did nothing to keep out the chill.
"Which animal is the most cunning?"
asked Nrithi, stroking the blade between her fingers. I frowned. That wasn't a riddle. It was a matter of opinion.
"Flustered so soon by our game?" asked Nrithi.
She raised the blade, tracing small, sharp circles on the exposed tops of my feet. Bear? Too lumbering. Tiger? Too noticeable. Sweat broke out between my shoulder blades. I didn't know the answer. I paused. I didn't know the answer. I cleared my throat.
"The one we have yet to discover."
Nrithi's smile curled into the barest of snarls. Behind her, one corner of Amar's lips quirked into a grin. Kamala laughed, stamping her hooves and tossing her head. But our game hadn't ended yet. Nrithi stepped forward.
"I am clothed but cannot grow. What am I?"
I swallowed my fear.
"You're either referring to one of two things. It's either me or moss over stone."
Behind Nrithi, Amar let out an exhale that might, if I strained that weak hope in my ribs, have been a laugh.
"I am pleased with her answers. Give over the boy," said Amar, with a lazy wave of his hand.
Nrithi smiled like her throat was full of broken glass, but she did as he said. She walked the boy to me and lifted her hand off his shoulder. The room was silent and still. I reached for him immediately, but no sooner had I done so did she snatch him back. She laughed and tilted her head.
"I said I would give you the boy. I didn't say for how long."
She swiveled toward Amar, and as she moved, I saw that there was something more than just a blade clasped to her salwar kameez. It was Amar's noose, coiled tight against her hip. She gripped it tightly.
"We need a soul, my lord. You said so yourself. If I do as you ask, the sadhvi must take his place. A soul for a soul."
Amar wasn't laughing anymore. The muscles in his neck tightened, his jaw clenched, but he didn't say anything. Nrithi's grip on the noose turned her knuckles white. She was controlling him. I bit back a snarl. Nrithi turned back to me, and her face was triumphant.
"No soul, no bargain."
Kamala whinnied, pulling against Gupta. I dropped my gaze to the ground, my heart frantic when I saw my sandals, mud crusted, tearing at the seams. I grinned. "Don't worry, Kamala," I thought. "I'm not dying."
"I have one."
When I spoke, my gaze was for Amar alone.
"Here,"
I said, tearing off the sandal and throwing it at Nrithi's feet.
"A soul for a soul."
Kamala began to laugh, and the deranged sound pitched off the walls, scattering between the bodies of the dark otherworld beings. They stood, slack-jawed and still. Only their eyes moved, bounding between me and Nriti and back. Before Nriti could speak, a creaking sound clattered through the room. Amar scooped the dirtied sandal in one hand before pulling me away from Nriti. His grip crushed into my arm, strong as iron. But there was something else. He was trembling. I could feel it through my skin.
"I accept her, Bata. Release the boy," he said tonelessly. "But have her locked into the chamber to Naraka."
He turned to Nriti.
"Her demand insulted your honor. That cannot be allowed."
The blood drained from my face. Scaled and roughened hands tugged at my arms, and I was dragged from the dais. I kicked, trying to throw off my assailant's arms, but they were like shackles. From his throne, Amar stared, and beside him, Nriti's face glowed smugly. The beasts of the other world threw me behind a metal door sunken into the knotted trunk of a banyan tree. Inside, the sounds of the otherworldly beings outside stuttered into silence. In the shadowed room, softly glowing moths lit up the walls. Fear left me trembling. They were going to kill me. I turned around, looking for escape. Behind me was a great obsidian mirror, like the one I had once found in the rooms with the tree full of memories. In its reflection, the stone halls of Naraka glittered.
"You are not a sadhvi," said a voice.
I looked up, stunned to see Amar standing before me. He helped me to my feet, but I couldn't look at him. Every time I glanced into his face, that flat look of no recognition slashed through me. He jerked my chin up.
"Do not lie to me. Who are you?"
Tears prickled hot behind my eyes, and the answer I gave him was so true I could feel it echoing through all my hollow spaces. "I don't know." He released his hold on my chin, but he didn't step away.
"You asked to see me alone. Why?"
"Because I love you." But that didn't matter. Any moment now, Nriti could rush inside. All she would have to do was hold tightly to that noose, and Amar would be powerless against her. Maybe I couldn't save us, or what we once had, but I could save him. I could save Gauri.
"You need your noose back," I said, my voice low and urgent.
I looked to the door, my heart thudding.
"Nriti is controlling you. I know you. You would never drag 1,000 children to these depths or unleash monsters into the world. Power is about balance, remember?"
He stepped back, his face paling, black eyes narrowing to slits.
"I did not ask for your wisdom, false sadhvi. You do not know me."
My heart was breaking. I thought I knew, finally, what it meant to be a ghost. It meant speaking your words around a mouth full of loss. It meant grasping onto echoes and hoping, praying that the words still meant something.
"I know your soul," I said, my voice cracking. "Everything else is an ornament. You have a strange effect on me."
"Why is that?" he asked softly.
"Beside you, I am reminded of something I have forgotten."
My hands fell to my sides. There, beneath the rags of my robes, the fabric was raised and bumpy, and I knew what lay beneath it, a broken circlet of hair. I fished it out of the pocket. My whole body was trembling, shaking against its restraints of bone. Amar reached out to cup the back of my neck. I shuddered. I had forgotten how cold his hands were. Like the soul of winter had tangled itself in his fingers. He stared at me, and his gaze had all the finality of death. It was ferocious and terrible. A ravel of locked horns. He was searching me. I knew exactly what he was looking for. Himself. I twined the bracelet together, letting it hover mere inches from his skin. I had no expectation, no method, no strategy. I was blind and clinging to a bruised piece of hope, but it was all I had.
"You once said your soul could never forget mine," I said, sliding the mended bracelet around his wrist. Do you remember now? He inhaled sharply, like something had rent through him. Around his wrist, the bracelet glowed like a caught star.
Johnny, he breathed, staring at me.
He clutched his chest, an amazed smile turning his face incandescent. I grinned so widely that I thought the air would bend around us, pushing us together. His fingers entwined in my hair, and he tilted my face up. I was leaning toward him hungrily, but in the next instant his smile faltered. Amar's brow crumpled with pain. He stumbled, his knees buckling.
"What's wrong?" I started, moving to help him.
The door swung open, and Rithi stepped in and our eyes met. I knew then why she had avoided looking at me. She had known who I was the whole time.
"Let me kill you," she said soothingly, drawing out the blade. "I've already told all the beings outside that you have corrupted the Dharmaraja. They will descend on you like dawn upon the vestiges of night, and I will do nothing to honor your memory."
She paused and spared me a smile that sent icicles blooming across my chest.
"I will not wipe up your blood. I will not mourn you. I will not care."
"Trust me," she said, stroking the edge of her blade.
"It is better this way."
Nrithi spared a glance at Amar. He had sunk to his knees, his hands clutching his heart.
"Stop this," I said through gritted teeth. "Give him back the noose. You're killing him."
She tilted her head to one side, staring at the blade.
"I'm not killing him," she said calmly. "Not yet. The Dharmaraja is weak."
She stretched the noose tight, and Amar seized up, his breath coming out in staggering gasps. His face paled.
"Stop!"
I cried, lunging toward Nrithi, but with a flick of her wrist, I was thrown back against the wall. My head slammed against the metal with a resounding thud. Nrithi laughed and twisted the cord between pale fingers.
"I take no pleasure in squashing an ant, but you are a very peculiar insect, and all because the all-powerful Dharmaraja made a foolish mistake."
"What mistake?"
I asked, my voice barely above a whisper.
"You once knew me so well. You know how I am. Why would I give up this secret before the game is done?"
Nrithi took a step toward Amar. I fought to get to him first, but each step took me farther and farther away from him until my body was pressed against the rickety frames of the room.
"You said I was killing him," said Nrithi, kneeling beside him.
She glanced at the dagger, then at Amar.
"Who am I to make you a liar?"
My body contorted into a scream, but all the sound I might have scraped up from every recess of myself was useless against a sharp blade. I watched, paralyzed, as Nrithi sank the blade into his heart. Amar shuddered, his body tense. The muscles of his neck stood out in sharp relief. His eyes rolled back, the whites of his sockets glistening before they focused on me.
"Johnny,"
he said, a shaky smile curling his lips. Amar tapped his lips twice, one hand fluttering to his heart. And then he went still. I blinked back tears, and a scream wrenched from my throat. Grief cut me, separating me like a soul from its body. I was nothing more than a being of fury and heartbreak.
"Don't worry, my friend," said Nrithi.
She yanked the dagger from Amar's chest. It came away with a sickening, unclasping sound. Nausea roiled in my gut. Whatever magic Nrithi used kept me pinned to the wall, but that didn't stop my limbs from trembling.
"I won't let you languish alone. Let me put you out of your mortal misery and finish my efforts," said Nrithi. "It's an honor, truly. You will be the last person to die. After that, death is nothing."
Chapter 27 A Tangle of Thread. Nrithi flicked her wrist, and this time I fell to the ground, my knees slamming into the packed earth. Blood thrummed in my ears. Pain radiated through my body. I looked at Amar, sprawled across the floor, his wrist flung out.
The bracelet gleamed pale as moonstone against his skin. His eyes were fixed on the fathomless ceiling above us. He may have been immortal, but Nithi's control had rendered him into a mere echo of himself. He was worse than dead. Nithi's shadow fell across the floor. She was coming for me. I began to crawl toward Amar, ready to fold him to me in my last moments, but I stopped. That was what she wanted, what she expected. But that was where she was wrong. She had mistaken my strength for weakness. I loved Amar. I loved him enough that it catapulted my fear into frenzy, my hurt into hope. I didn't run to him because I had loved and lost. I ran from him because I loved him, and I would not lose him. Nrithi sent a sickening wave of magic my way. For a moment, I faltered. My legs nearly crumpled beneath me. Tongues of flame lit up the floor, turning everything around me ghastly and shadowed. But I didn't stop. I didn't turn. My gaze was fixed on the obsidian mirror glittering at one end of the room. In the portal's reflection, Naraka's stone halls twinkled. My feet stamped into the ground, closer and closer. Heat seared my lungs. The moments between escaping Nrithi and entering Naraka sprang out like thorns, each one pricking at me, each one sharper than the next, each one a knot of pain. Until finally, my hands touched the mirror's cool surface. My singed fingers skimmed something smooth as glass. And I pushed. The stolen moment from entering one world to the next raised the hairs on the back of my neck and twisted my insides. But then I was through. Behind me, the portal shivered, the surface curdling black. I stood in one of Naraka's pale halls. Lanterns sprang along the stones. Beside me, a carven niche in the wall held a small statue of a Mina bird. I grabbed it, and with all the strength I had left, pitched it straight into the mirror. The surface crackled, light seeming along the edges. I didn't know whether it would keep Nithi away long enough for me to do what needed to be done, but I had to try. Against her, I was powerless. I was mortal. She thought that was a weakness, but I knew better. Being mortal meant that I had a thread hidden somewhere in that tapestry. Being mortal meant that I could free myself from the tapestry. It meant that I still had a chance to claim the powers that were once mine, to fight back against Nithi. I blinked back tears, trying to forget how still Amar's body looked on the floor. He wasn't gone. He couldn't be. I flew down the halls when I saw it, the throne room. A sieve of dust coated the floor. The air settled heavy and neglected around my shoulders. Outside, the sky of Naraka was a lurid yellow, and ice spidered and crackled against the ledges. The moment my feet hit the floor, a familiar tug in my gut wrenched my gaze away from the window. The tapestry. Its pull had not diminished. If anything, its strange lull from before had turned into a pulsing, writhing frenzy. It twisted in and out of sight, shapes sinking and remolding the longer I looked at them. In one second, the threads became bleached as bone, bulging out from the surface until it turned into the beveled form of a white elephant who shook his head with sorrow and bent his trunk to collect a thunderstorm. Airavata. Color burst prismatic into the threads, each piece of silk or worsted crewel sliding into the burnt landscape of a realm I knew so well, Bharata. Again and again the tapestry changed, a horse with its ribs poking out of its sides, garnet eyes rolling back into its head, a young man clambering onto a throne, Gauri riding in the dark, a sea of cells beneath my feet in Naraka. Each individual in its confines shivering, waiting, wondering. I even saw my father in those threads. His brow was creased, his fingers skimming over the mirrored walls of his prison, wondering when he would be released into the next life. And I saw myself, not as a former queen who had once commanded the tapestry, but as a woman with her back bent in sorrow and age, still wearing the same saffron sadhvi robes, peddling tales to anyone who would listen. Tears ran freely down my face. The tapestry was taunting me. Every single one of those images was an invitation to fall to my knees and admit that I couldn't save them, that I couldn't save myself. I steeled my heart's frantic, veering beat. The tapestry was testing me. It wasn't prophetic. It could augur nothing from entrails of thread. It was a design, and designs could be altered. Somewhere in that swirling thicket was my thread, and I had to untangle it from the black widening hole of the tapestry. I marched forward, letting the tapestry call to me, sing to me, serenade its secrets and entwine about my ankles. I let it fill me and guide me to myself. I flung out my hands, breathing slowly and deeply, pushing out all the sounds I imagined in the background, of mirrors crackling, and an entrance tearing. My fingers skittered over the tapestry, hovering over threads that I knew weren't mine, and then I felt it, a pinch in my soul, and something startling me, like a word caught in my throat. I reached forward, my eyes burning at the sight of the tapestry. Sweat beaded on my skin, and my breath fell out in damp heaves. My thread was slick, shining as indigo and oil, but it was caught in something, another thread that was white-hot and iridescent. Nriti. I braced myself, knowing what would happen the moment my skin touched the threads. I remembered my insides wrenching around Vikram's thread all those days ago. I remembered the tapestry weighing me and finding me wanting. I remembered his past flickering like a beating heart in my hands. It had been hard then, and that was just one soul. Now I was plunging myself into two lifetimes. The two threads seared against my palm. Pain flared behind my eyes, and I was falling, my feet slipping against the dusted marble, my whole body tilting around the inferno of the tapestry. I clutched the two threads, and my hands burned. I screamed, but never heard myself. The room had lapped up my shrieks. The skin on my hands peeled back. I was being pried open, each bone lifted from my body to make room for memories. Memories stout as trunks, thin as lightning, furred and fanged, solid and slippery. Memories that were mine and Nriti's. Memories that were starving for recognition. Memories so hungry they consumed. The threads called, and I answered. It was too late to turn back now. Chapter 28. Lost Names. I remembered my lost names. I unfurled them, smoothing their worn creases, inhaling their scent of star-swollen evenings and monsoon dusks. Nriti had lied. I was no Yakshini by the edges of forest glens. I was more, so much more. I clasped my lost names to me. Yamuna. The name barreled around my ankles, brackish and forceful. A river striped with tortoises and water that glowered and snapped, a force that could drown. Yamini. The name pressed a cool hand against my heart, warm as freshly wrought stars flung into the winter black of night. The names gave me strength. They gave me history. They gave me one more secret to myself, and I would know them all. I opened my eyes, squinting against the brightness as two images spun around before converging into a single scene. Nriti was dancing in Patala, a part of the sprawling otherworld that held neither sun nor moon, but remained bright with sparkling, unearthly jewels. She danced in 100 courts, content, happy, the pride of all the devas and asuras. And then she met Vanaj, the youngest son of a mortal king, brought to the otherworldly court for his role in vanquishing 5 rakshas who had plagued sacred grounds. He loved her, and she loved him. And in such bliss does devastation grow. They spent years in each other's arms, wandering groves, living as hermits in an ashram of marble where nothing grew around them but lush fruit trees. No one murmured their discontent, but the silver fish in the nearby rivers. Nothing interrupted their lovemaking but the cusp of dawn and the famished growl of their own bodies. Then came the war of the two sundered families, and Vinaj was called away. Nriti stood before me, her lovely face wasted, gaunt. She stood in Naraka's palace, facing the thrones where Amar and I sat.
"You must help me, sister. He is dying, I know it. I have done everything I can," her voice cracked. "I have performed the severest of penances. I have begged each sage. I can do no more."
Amar looked at me and my heart clenched. I knew that gaze. Resignation. Already I knew where Vinaj's thread hovered, flickering, unraveling from the grand tapestry. But there was nothing that could be done. Some threads left no ambiguity for life or death. And Nriti saw it in my face.
"Traitor," she hissed.
"What can I do, sister?" I beseeched her. "Even we are powerless, but I can follow his soul, remake him anew. You need only wait, and he will be your Vinaj again."
"I want him back."
"You cannot," said Amar softly. "We know your pain, but..."
Nriti laughed, her eyes wide.
"You? You don't know my pain. Neither of you do. You sit there, commanding life or death as though it was nothing but a foolish child's game."
Amar stood up, his face stony.
"There is nothing we can do."
"Yes, there is," she screamed, tearing at her hair. "He doesn't have to die. Who let you decide? Why are either of you fit to take away life? Death is unnecessary,"
she hissed, hurling her curses at both of us. She would not listen. Even when I tried to find her, day after day, year after year, I spent hours poring over the tapestry, seeking out her thread, but it was as though she had vanished. I saw Nriti stalking burial grounds and defiling ancient temples. She walked through crowded villages, murmuring under her breath. The moment she touched something, tree bark, cow skin, a boy's forehead, they burned and burned. She entered in silence and left in chaos. She trailed it, dropping fury like candies. The golden-skinned Apsara, with the quick smile, and the eyes like crystal, was gone. Replaced with an equally beautiful, but terrifying and bloodless version of herself. I saw her watching me through the obsidian mirror that we used to summon one another. I saw her pressing herself against it and snarling.
"One day your inadequacy will sneak up on you, like shadows upon bodies. One day your pride will fall like glass, and when it does, I'll be there to take back what is mine."
I remembered the terrible decision that fell to me. A deva had been cursed to rebirth as a mortal man. I weighed his crime of theft and measured his life thread, spinning out his doom and death, inscribing those truths on his forehead. For his terrible crime, a terrible end, death on the battlefield, a bed of arrows for his funeral pyre. He would take no wife. He would bounce no child upon his knee or know the joy of love. But he would be illustrious and wise, and when his time on earth expired, the heavens would embrace him once more. And as I spun it, sang it, and wrote it, so it became. Fury and rumors flitted to the other world that the Rani of Naraka had befouled her title with her decisions. I paid no attention to the rumors, but Amar did.
"If this continues, they will storm our palace. I cannot let that happen. We have the sanctity of the balance to maintain."
I flinched. Something in his words felt strangely distant.
"Do you believe them?"
"Of course not," he said, waving a dismissive hand. But I caught a tremor in his fingers. "Still, we need to control the peace. We must care what they think."
"Why? It won't change anything. It's your..."
He caught his words. "Our reputation."
The realms held council in illustrious courts above the clouds, where thunder stalked in the corners and lightning crowned each throne. The air was uncommonly bright, livid with sunshine and splendor. Many-limbed devas reclined on carved clouds, clutching ambrosial soma in golden goblets as they questioned me. Throughout my questioning, the Dharmaraja stood by my side, a silken shadow against all this light. I believed in myself, and with Amar supporting me, my decision was invincible.
"How could you be so cruel?" exclaimed one. "No wife in his mortal life?"
"His wife would not be reincarnated with him. I will not give him another." A woman with a white veil, whose skin glowed like dawn, shot me a trembling smile.
"And what about his brothers? Did they not also partake in his crime of theft?" retorted another.
"They did," I said.
"Then why must he endure a whole life as a human, when his brothers live less than a year in that realm?"
"Because they were accomplices, not the instigators of the crime. It was he who committed the most wrong. It is he who must live the longest." The Deva beside me stomped his feet, and lightning flared behind him.
"And what say you, Dharmaraja? How will you defend your queen's decision?"
I remembered holding my chin high, surveying the crowd with the tasteful indifference of one who knew she was impervious. And I remembered when that moment fell with his next words.
"If you doubt her, then I propose an Agni Pariksha. Fire will always tell."
The Devas and Devis nodded approvingly to themselves. A trial by fire. Humiliation burned through me. I dropped my hand from his, and the world broke between us. Betrayal felt bitter and acrid in my throat, and the ghost of it was everywhere, taunting my reflection. How could he do this to me? How could he doubt me so much to expose me to the ridicule and glances of the celestial world? All this time, Amar said nothing. Our bed became a cold thing, and my heart froze with it. I remembered the night I awoke all alone, my eyes still puffed and swollen from weeping. Our bed was empty, the room echoing. I heard my name called through a mirror portal that Nithi had once used. Silently I walked through the halls, my hair unbound and catching along the newfound icicles hanging across marble eaves. Nrithi was there, waiting. I ran to embrace her, not once seeing that her fingers were stained red, that the smell of rot clung to her. I was blind.
"I forgive you," she said tonelessly, "and I come in warning."
"Of what?"
"Your Dharmaraja has turned on you, sister."
Her words became my poison, and I let it fill me, blind me, until all I saw was betrayal. Nrithi fed me images through an obsidian portal, Amar tearing out the tapestry threads like throats, of him gloating in the fallen lives, of him ignoring my words, waiting for the moment where he could use the Agni Pariksha to exile me forever.
"You were nothing but his dark plaything," Nrithi said,
and I let myself believe her. On the day of the Agni Pariksha, light transfixed Amar's face.
"I have every faith in you, my love," he said, trailing fingers along my jaw. "This will put an end to every rumor. This will keep you safe from them. I know our days have been cold, but after this we will be as we once were."
Inside, my heart snarled, but I kept my face blank.
"I will not disappoint."
All the members of the other world assembled for my trial. I wore white, the dress of mourning. In the night bazaar, a dim glow lit up the faces of the attendees, clinging to well-oiled horns and scaled skin. Leonine rakshas waited patiently, weapons quivering in their grip. If I failed, they were free to depose me. If I succeeded, they would end their bloodshed in the human realms. Sacred flames lapped up from the ground. Ribbons of fire snaked out like tongues and grasping hands. I looked to Amar. His face was stern, hopeful. For what outcome, I thought I knew. But I was wrong. The Agni Pariksha scraped through me, burning talons that combed through my being. Survive unscathed, and it was proof of my worthiness as queen. I did not doubt that I would pass. The question was what to do after. Nrithi's words floated through my mind as I burned and burned and burned. He wants you to fail, sister. He does not know how strong you are. When you succeed, leave. Leave his horrible kingdom. Let him fend for himself. Let him weep. Let him fail. Start anew, with me. Nrithi had fed me so many images, Amar dancing with a beautiful Nagini in a sea palace carved of glass, Amar flinching from my touch. My tongue was full of smoke and heartbreak. My mind was full of lies. I don't remember when the Agni Pariksha ended. I only remembered emerging, my ankles encircled with ash, a deafening roar, applause or resentment, fury or joy, as I left. And I remember Amar's face, one dark eyebrow arched, as he surveyed the crowd, a proud smirk on his face, as though he expected this all along. All that time, I thought he was merely pretending. In Naraka, a feast awaited me. Every room dripped silver. Glass blooms and petals carpeted the floor. The walls of our kingdom shimmered, as if underwater and moonlight glimmered through the lattice windows. Sweet kefir cream and pista cakes in golden bowls lay piled high among the tables, but I would touch none of it. "Are you disappointed?" I asked coldly. Amar slipped his arms around my waist.
"I always believed in you. It is the world outside who needed convincing." "Liar," I hissed, stepping out of the ring of his arms. "What is the meaning of this? You humiliated me. You left me to them like carrion before vultures, and like vultures they devoured me." My voice was hoarse and brittle. I hated him. I hated him for abandoning me. I hated him for needing him. Amar stepped back, his jaw clenched. "I did it to quell dissent, to keep you safe. I was ashamed that I had to ask you to undergo the Agni Pariksha."
"So ashamed you distanced yourself from me the moment you demanded that trial?"
Amar looked stunned. "I am the Dharmaraja for a reason. I would not have my own impartiality questioned by favoring you. Surely you knew this."
"What would you have done if I failed?"
"You couldn't fail," said Amar. "That's why I did not worry. You were meant to be the queen of these lands. We were meant to rule together, for all of eternity."
"I would rather die than rule by the side of a coward."
Shadows curled away from Amar's body.
"Coward?" he hissed. "Cowardice is running from the difficult choices made by the ones that love you most. If I have been a coward, so have you, Jani. But we may start anew. Let us not speak of this time any longer."
He tried once more to tilt my face into a kiss, but I moved away.
"I saw you spread the rumors yourself in the other world. I watched you take solace in another's arms. And if surviving the Agni Pariksha means spending eternity with you, then I would rather live life as a mortal."
The room became damp and sticky with darkness.
"What lies you hurl at me," he murmured. "I don't trust you."
He stepped back, wounded.
"Has your judgment become so compromised? If you truly do not believe the truth in my words, then you have no place here."
We stared at one another, fury swelling between us. The silence expanded, solidifying our words like manacles.
"Once I thought you loved me," I said in a broken voice. "I refuse to live in your shadow for the rest of eternity."
His eyes widened, obsidian eyes searching and disbelieving.
"Then leave,"
he said, gesturing to the door angrily. So I did. I stepped into the reincarnation pool, letting the waters tease my life apart, inflicting upon myself the same curse that had forced me to undergo the Agni Pariksha. In the distance, Amar's voice roared for me, pleading, but it was too little, and far too late.
I blinked furiously, and the images spun away. The two threads lay against my palm, scalding and writhing like twin serpents. My head was full of what I had seen, and what I now knew. I had allowed myself to hear lies, and never questioned their truth. I had let suspicion rule me at a terrible price. My grip on the threads tightened. I had to release myself from her hold. Outside,